Today we're going to talk about labor, the state of labor, and different perspectives of labor. I'm coming from a truly black perspective, not African-American. I'm coming from the black perspective. CBTU, which is not like it used to be. The blacks were Teamsters, on and on. What was it, TDU or whatever it was? And so we have some people who precede me labor-wise, which is Leo. And then we have somebody who's behind me labor-wise with his Anthony. And from my understanding locally, ILWU has pretty much been the union that steps up. So anyway, maybe Steve might want to conch the conversation.
Well, I mean, I think that the ILWU has played an important role in advancing the struggles against racism and other issues more than most unions. But there's been a struggle, a constant struggle in all the unions to build a democratic and an anti-racist union, really.
Leo?
Well, this is going to call for the airing of some dirty laundry.
I hear you.
You know, I mean, let me preface my remarks by saying this to you. I am by no means anti-union. I am pro-union from top to bottom. But I also realize that there are problems within the trade union movement, including the ILWU. As you just mentioned, some organizations, CBTU for one, the Teamsters Black Caucus, almost any major union that you look to has some type of an organization within the larger union as a whole that represents the interest of the minority members of that union, whether they be black or Hispanic. But for purposes of this conversation, I'll just confine my remarks to the struggle that blacks have to wage within the trade union movement for their democratic rights.
And in SEIU, we had the AFRAM. That's a weird name. I was part of the AFRAM.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also, I was part of APRI, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing about joining all the black constituency groups, I kind of felt we were living in the past, because definitely you guys had took care of business. But it seemed like, from my perspective, that we were waiting for the union leadership to tell us what to do or what was okay.
Well, that was your first mistake. That was your first mistake, is waiting for the union leadership, because as I was once told by the leadership within the ILWU, we're aware of the problems, but we have our own agenda, which meant that they were busy consolidating their hold on power, and so they would then leave the locals or the individuals to do what they had to do as best they could. You know, the struggle for minority workers inside the trade union movement is not a new phenomenon. This has been going on since trade unions were formed in this country. I mean, at its inception, it was racist. That is not to say that there aren't white workers or weren't white workers within the trade union movement who didn't join the struggle against racism. But by and large, the leadership of the trade union movement down through the years have been, if not outright racist themselves, they've tolerated it. With few exceptions, but there are a few exceptions.
One of the dynamics that I've seen is it's just like, you know, anything. It's like you get people together, you kind of, I call it Jim Jonas kind of interaction, where you get people on causes, they're really working on the cause. So somehow unionism went from blacks fighting for their place in the labor movement and having constituency groups to now we're fighting for the immigrants, for the other person, and on, these very people that, when they get it, they're not relating to us because they don't see us in the positions and they don't necessarily respect us. And so we go after this big battle and we start intellectualizing. But as we intellectualize, our kids are dying. The labor isn't really going out there and letting them know there's trades that they can participate in. We're not going out there and trying to, at least I was trying to get them to donate money to some of the mothers who died, you know, who kids died and stuff, because a lot of people who are dying, their parents are in unions and stuff. And if we're supposed to be taking care of each other, what was going on with that? And
I would just like to step in there and speak about the ILWU and the hiring system that they have. It's pretty much a lottery system. You come down with your ID and your Social Security number, and they do a lottery. And from that lottery, people get picked to come in. And here in Oakland, it's predominantly black workers. So Local 10 did a good thing for black workers. But the problem is, the union doesn't think outside of the walls of the union and their members. Since they have so much control over wealth, which is the shipping and cargo coming in, they doesn't use that power to even uplift the people in the local community in Oakland. You know, we did a shutdown for the war, which I totally agree with. I'm against the war 100%. But we could have started with something definitely more local, with programs of training. You know, we spent millions of dollars giving it to the Democrats, you know, to put ourselves in power. I mean, to get ourselves in a good position, you know, to help us with our contracts. I mean, whether it's black, white, Latino, whatever it is, we're taking care of the people only within that union. If you in, you in. And yes, it is some discrimination within the union itself, but it only becomes those walls that we care about and benefit us, instead of using our power that we have to expand and help those young people that are dying out there and let them know there are good jobs out there. And we have to fight to maintain those good jobs by not selling out the generation to come or the old timers with some of these contracts we have sold to just fatten our own pockets.
Well, let me respond to this. First off, may I ask you, are you a member of the ILWU?
Yes, I am.
Local 10?
Yes.
Okay, then you should know. When did you come in?
99.
Okay. What city did you come from?
Compton.
You came from Compton, yes, into the ILWU, yeah, Local 10?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Compton, but I was living in San Francisco at the time.
Okay, now let me respond to you some of the things that you said. And I'm not in the business of defending. I'm just merely stating the facts. I guess it was around 88, because I retired in 1999. When we hired, we got the employers to agree that we would hire a certain allocate a certain amount of those new hires to specific areas, namely in West Oakland and in the Fruitvale area of Oakland, in which those jobs those new entrants had to come from those areas into the ILWU. Okay? So that was unique in and of itself. Our hiring, if people don't know, we don't hire one-for-one basis. People come in large groups. I came in 63. There were 714 of us that came in when I came in. And then there was another hiring in 65, 67, 69, and then from 69 until the late 80s or the early 90s, there were no hires out of Local 10 except for the replacement of what we call the permissive rule, which is the sons, daughters, wives of longshoremen who die while they're active. Okay? Now, the question of taking the struggle against racism beyond the confines of a particular union or of a particular local is something that I know something about, because I've done it. You cannot separate the community in which you live from the job that you do. One is a question of circumstance. The other is a fact of life. You live somewhere. But by chance or who you know or what you know, you get a job someplace. But you can't separate the two. And I'm going to give you a specific example. Back in the mid-70s, there was an incident that took place up in Oroville, California, in which two young black sisters up there were being harassed by the local Klansmen or whatever they were up there. And I heard about it on the radio. I called the station. I got their names and their phone numbers. I called them. And then for the next union meeting, I went up there, got them, and brought them back to Local 10, where they told their story to the membership. The membership then voted to hold our next union meeting, which, by the way, was the only meeting that's ever been held outside of Local 10 by Local 10. We held our meeting in the streets of Oroville, in which we marched with our union banner in support of those two sisters. The harassment stopped. Now, insofar as our own members are concerned, we had a brother that I grew up with, Roosevelt Presley. He's deceased now. He lived out in Pinole. He was a mechanic at Crockett Sugar processing plant there in Crockett. He was being harassed to the point to where they were throwing rocks and stones in his house. Now, there were some members who said we should go up there with our guns and all that sort of stuff and hold to respond to that. And then there were some of us who had cooler heads that said, no, we won't do that. What we did was, we hired the union, the local 10, hired security guards and put them around his house, his block, 24 hours a day for almost a month. In the meantime, we also met with the sheriff of Contra Costa County and the police officials there in Pinole and said we wanted that stopped. And it stopped. Now, that's the kind of, the sensible responses that one makes either to something within the union or something out in the community as a whole. And then there have been other instances where we've responded to racism, because racism is attended by sexism, xenophobia, and everything else. So those are the kinds of responses that a responsible union or rank-and-file members of a union make to racism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have the issues that have happened in unions. In my union, the operating engineers, there was an incident of hanging nooses right here in San Francisco. And I tried to bring it up at the union meeting. I brought the sister who was being harassed, black sister engineer, and they adjourned the union meeting when they saw us coming in there, because they knew we were going to be talking about this incident. And when I brought it up to the business agent, he said, well, we don't know who did it. We don't want to talk about it. It might not be one of our members. But what I'm concerned about is, I mean, there have been other racist incidents, a hanging noose in Los Angeles, in the port of Los Angeles, that happened, and that was by ILWU members. But what I'm concerned about also is, the systemic exclusion of blacks and removal of blacks from good-paying jobs that's going on in this country. A large number of public jobs are being privatized. Black workers are being discriminated against in San Francisco in the hotels. There are many industries in San Francisco where young black workers can't get jobs. And they hire everybody else but black workers. There are discrimination suits against some of these hotels. This whole issue of hanging nooses in Gina, the unions had no response to that. There was only one union, APWU, the postal workers, that shut down their civil rights department in Washington and paid locals to send busloads of people down to Gina. But for the most part, the unions were not involved in fighting these incidents, these hanging noose incidents. And there's a whole epidemic of hanging noose incidents all over this country. You wouldn't know about it because they basically are allowed to be isolated. And so I think that there has to be a discussion about the failure and what to change the situation in the labor movement to address these issues, these broader issues, and to mobilize people against the attacks on workers and particularly black workers, which is not happening in the trade unions, really, in general.
I got a question. I'm a city and county employee, and I know you're not supposed to have a felony to work for the city. Is it the same to be a longshoreman?
No.
Although with TWICS.
It's changed with the TWICS card. It's going to go back 7 years.
Okay. Because if you look at a lot of the situations that the young black and brown men are getting into, a lot of them have felonies. And how do you get a job if you already have a felony? So even though it could be true that there's fewer blacks in the unions or in these particular positions, but I've had relatives that were used to work at a Clift Hotel and all these different places, and some people don't want to do it, and some people are in situations where they're just not looking that way. And so my question is, or my statement is some of it is our fault too. And so that was my thing, that when I was part of CBTU and the AFRAM at SEIU Local 250, was to try to get us as rank and file people to go back to the community and, you know, mentor our people, be responsible for our people, and tell them the truth. It's like, CBTU doesn't have any money, then tell them the truth why we don't have any money. You know, APRI does certain things, you know, just be truthful, because they see it anyway. The issue that I kept seeing over and over, especially in UHW or whatever we've permutated into, was that we had a lot of women, Latino women and black women in our union, and their kids were being killed. And we were not addressing that, not as brothers, not as union brothers, not anything. And I think as a union member, if you're supposed to be in this so-called union family, then why couldn't we reach out?
I'll try to respond to some of that.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, August 27th and 28th of this year in Seattle will be a coastwise meeting of the AALC, that's the African American Longshore Coalition, which I helped to form in 1992. While Local 10 may be relatively free from such things as the hanging nooses and screening people through the drug and alcohol program and all that sort of stuff, I found out in 1992 that all was not well within the ILWU family. And so we formed the AALC. Because the brothers in the Pacific North, brothers and the sisters in the Pacific Northwest, as well as L.A., were catching hell, but nobody knew about it because nobody talked about it. And so we formed the AALC. And one of the things that came out of that was the, for those, of, I mean, within the union itself, Local 10 has never worried about the question of black representation at the higher levels of the union, okay? But you couldn't even, even in L.A., with its fairly large black membership, couldn't even elect a black to the executive board without white sponsorship, okay? in the Pacific Northwest, that wasn't even a thought, getting on the executive board or handling labor relations cases. They had, some of them didn't, I mean, they were denied access to the Constitution. They didn't even have a copy of the contract. So all of these things we came together to address, and then slowly but surely we, and it's not over yet. I mean, it's still going on, because as has been said, the question of, You first got to get hired before you can get all this training and all promotions and all this. So you can't do anything until you get hired. And the question before us right now is this continuation of selective hiring. But we're steadily making up ground. The one problem that we have that you've just mentioned is that those who are in the union, once they get in, it's like they close their mind to the problems that people outside of the union who are still trying to get in, they close their minds to those people. You know, they don't want to participate for whatever reason. Some of them, they can't stand the heat that's put on them for joining organizations like the AALC. It's difficult. We started a CBTU chapter in both Seattle and in Portland, but the national organization was sort of hesitant because of who we were. The Northern California chapter was known as a group of radicals. You know, we were sort of like the ultra leftists. And all that sort of stuff. So we've had to struggle against those kinds of things, but it's a question of you're not going to get 100% of people to do anything. What you've got to get is that 4 or 5 or 3 or whatever the number is who are willing to wage that long-term struggle, you know, to change things. We changed the dispatch system in the Port of Tacoma, and now you couldn't get those white workers to go back to that old discriminatory system. You couldn't force it on them again, because they saw that there's only so many pieces of pie that can be handed out once you cut it up. And so the leadership of that local was using that division of the pie to stay in power. And so we broke that. We made them change the Constitution in Portland. They had to change the Constitution in Portland to conform to the international Constitution. It's not a case of people, everybody rushing toward one goal. It's a question of getting those who see the goal, and then getting them to struggle toward that goal, more or less.
This is Leroy Moore. You know, I'm the youngest one here. I'm 40 years old, and the thing that I see around in cities, I grew up in Harlem, grew up in Detroit, grew up back east. I see a lot of gentrification. I see black businesses leaving the community. And I see, you know, our people traveling to richy neighborhoods for jobs. So my thing is that in Harlem, a couple of weeks ago, black organizations took over Harlem and had like 1,000 hands around Harlem to try to get a symbolize of trying to take back Harlem and try to bring more black organizations and jobs in Harlem. So I'm just wondering, what is the union and labor doing about the tragedy of gentrification and the black communities?
Well, if I might, I don't know exactly. I know what gentrification is, and I know that it takes place. But until the black worker starts to put in that constant pressure, nothing is going to happen. The leadership is certainly not going to take the lead in it. They're not going to address it. The politicians are not going to address it in a meaningful way, because they're counting their votes. And it has to come from at the rank and file level. And as I said, it doesn't take a whole herd of people. It only takes a small group of people who are dedicated to that cause to start to get people involved. And, I mean, it's a long, drawn-out process that takes years in some cases to get people to see what you're saying. You know, gentrification, I mean, I've seen it since I don't live in the Bay Area anymore. I moved out of the Bay Area after I retired. But certainly, I've seen Oakland start to change. Every time I come up there and I look at all of the new apartments and townhouses that are being built, you know, I know that black youth are not involved in the building of these new houses, and they're certainly not going to live in them. So that's gentrification right on. So what it takes is a coalition of people from the trade union movement, perhaps from the religious community, political activists, to start to put that high on the agenda. See, people get distracted from whatever their agenda is by adopting somebody else's agenda, so that their stuff gets lost in the shuffle. But if that's what your goal is, then that's the only thing that you concentrate on, you know, as a priority. You know,
one of the things in San Francisco is Hunters Point and Bayview, and the development of Hunters Point and Bayview, because there's a Lennar, there's a developer that wants to develop it. They say they want to develop it, although apparently they're going bankrupt now. But the fact of the matter is a lot of the development is going to be for the wealthy or for people who have a lot of money. And I think in addition to that, some of the workers, there was a recent incident in at some of these construction projects where they were pitting the Latino contractor was pitting the Latino carpenters, and they were union carpenters, Local 22, against the black carpenters right here in San Francisco. It was like plantation politics, having them fight each other and blame each other, and they were shortchanging the Latino carpenters. But I think it's a social crisis in this country where working people can't afford to live in the cities anymore. They have to commute, and now with the price of gas, they can't afford to commute, and workers are quitting their jobs because they can't even afford the gas. So I think the political problem in the cities is the developers and the Democratic Party run the system, and it's run for the developers. It's not run for working-class housing. So even though there's a dire need for working-class housing, there are not thousands of units for working-class people to live in San Francisco. So they have no choice. If you have a family, you have to move out of San Francisco. You have to move out of Oakland. You're forced. And I think that's a political problem which the unions really are not addressing, the question of housing and working-class housing for their members. Where are their members going to live? I mean, even firefighters, teachers can't afford to live in San Francisco. So it's something the unions have to address.
Well, I think when Leo made the statement about sticking to your agenda, if your agenda as a union member is to make sure we have houses, then we would have houses. Labor has pension funds. I was part of a group that we tried to make. We tried to convert all the apartments in San Francisco into it was called Proposition Co-op. M. And we were trying to make them into co-ops. That's right.
Yeah.
And quite a few people, all they did was identify the Indian brother and targeted him, even though all the renter groups and the presidents of the renters associations, they all owned property. The Randy Shaw lives in Kensington and on and on. And nobody seemed to have any issue about these people who were supposed to be the activists being landowners and capitalists. But for those of us who were stepping up, especially with a man of color in the lead, somehow we were trying to create tycoons and stuff. So my thing is, like, I agree with what Leo says. You just got to believe in something, take the point, and stick with your agenda. And then you can always incorporate somebody else's agenda into your agenda, but stay on point. I mean, it's just like right now we're on KPU, and when we offered to SEIU in particular this slot, they ignored us, and then now that they're in total chaos, they at the last minute threw up a website and, you know, trying to get on the radio and stuff. But we presented that to them almost 2 years ago, and I'm sure it was because of the people that were involved compared to what was going on. And some people just don't want to give up power. But if you look at stuff historically, I mean, a war was stopped by young people, the Martin Luther King led young people. You know, all these things, these brothers, what this brother's talking about back in the day, sound like he was a young man. You know, nobody told him what to do. They just went on and did it. And my thing is, like, which is what we were trying to do in bringing the young people onto this radio show, was to get them to go back to their roots and to look at things critically. But they seem to be, for like what my brother was saying, they have another agenda that they don't even know. And part of the agenda is this bling bling and shooting, and you must be stupid to have a job, and just a lot of stuff that when I was growing up, my grandmother, I mean, you had to, that's all they instilled in us. You had to talk better than them. You had to look better than them. You had to be cleaner than them, and you're going to get half as much. You was going to get half as much, and you were still doing great. You were still doing great because you got half. I mean, you couldn't, you had to speak English a certain way. There was just things that we had to do. And now it's like the opposite. But it doesn't mean that things won't change. But I like the point about sticking to your agenda.
Well, let me say this for what it's worth. The brother, the young brother there that's in Local 10 now, I'm sure that he will confirm what I'm going to say. Back in 1988, I believe, when we started our hiring process, I had made a resolve as a member of the executive board. At the time, I was also probably on the member of the caucus and convention and a few other little offices that I held in the local. But that I was determined that the people who came behind me into the industry would not come in uneducated as to what the union was about and its history. And right now, one of the requirements, because I wrote those rules, and I don't know whether they're still in effect or not, but I wrote the rules in such a way that you could not get your A registration without attending stewards council meetings, membership meetings, executive board meetings. Those were requirements for you to get your book, so that you became at least educated enough to handle yourself as an ILWU member. You had got a copy of the contract, you got a copy of the Constitution when you came in through the door. So that my premise was always, if you don't know your rights, you don't have any. And so that was the underpinning of the educational program that is now, as I understand it, coastwise on the waterfront, although they don't give Local 10 credit for starting it. Hmm. Now, again, if people have a point that they want to make or a policy that they want to institute, the union, at least in the ILWU and Local 10, is set up in such a way that any rank and filer can get up and put a question on the floor, have it acted upon, can even create a committee out of thin air that concentrates on nothing but that issue. The May Day thing that just went down. The May Day thing didn't just pop up out of thin air, as I'm sure Steve can tell you. That came from the Million Worker March. The Million Worker March came from two rank and filers who are active in the union and myself. That's how it started. And it culminated in Washington, D.C., and while people don't think that it's still alive on the East Coast, and it's still alive here on the West Coast, that the members of the Million Worker March were the ones who organized, by and large, the May Day celebration. The offices of the local, the offices of the international had nothing to do with the organization of the May Day work stoppage or shutdown, whatever you want to call it. It's a matter of you seeing something that needs to be done and say, well, hell, I can give 2 hours a month to that. It's a worthy cause, and that's what you do. I spent the better part of 20 years of my life in the anti-apartheid movement. And at the end of it, South Africa is free. Mm-hmm. Namibia is free. All of the Southern African frontline states are free. But that's the way that you have to approach the questions that we're talking about here. Well, and primarily, And I want to say this with as much emphasis as I can. Racism cannot be passed off, swept under the rug, any of that. It has to be addressed constantly and with some force behind it. You can't just get up in a union meeting or over in the, at the bar and say, well, such and such a union is racist. Well, okay, it's racist. We know that. Now, what do you do about it? That's the question. How do you address that question? Because the purposes of unions are quite different from what they are, what in actuality. So then you have to make that a reality.
So why don't you address that, Anthony? You're the younger. You're new labor.
Yeah. The May Day was a success. I also went to the Million Man's March in Washington. That was good. But there's no extended program from these events, the May Day or the Million Man March. And I would like to add, it's hard to address racism without addressing free market and capitalism, which, in my opinion, racism has stemmed from. I mean, because slavery wasn't about race. It was about cheap labor.
Absolutely.
You know? And you know, when the slaves was free, then they came across the Italian union lines, and even now we have, like, the Mexican workers who's coming in being cheap labor, and all the blacks and people here.
And don't forget the East Indian.
And the East Indians. And so we have to address capitalism and free market first. But the issue of black oppression has to be hand-in-hand with that. It has to be...
I don't disagree.
It has to be hand-in-hand with that. So that, in that regard, I think that's why the unions are handcuffed to what they can do, because they fall in line with believing in the capitalist system. They only going to go so far to push, you know, for a little change, but not completely change the whole system to where one person can own a whole shipping company. And until we deal with these issues, you're going to always have racism. It's going to always be in place, and it can't be dealt with in an individual act. I'm going to deal with this situation that happened in L.A. and this situation that happened here. It has to be dealt in a whole, because most workers, from my experience in the union, when they're making good money, they're having a good job, they feel good, they're taking care of their family, and guys work side by side with each other. And you can work next to a Mexican worker, but he still feels an enemy of that immigrant Mexican worker. He don't see him as his brother. So the idea of race being the biggest thing, I kind of have to say we have to deal with the free markets first. That's, I wanted to add that to the conversation.
How can we?
No.
How can we support you though? Because you're the next wave.
Let me say in response to that, I agree with you that a trade unionist, if they stop and really think about what they say they believe in, it's from the left. It's mm-hmm. anti-imperialist, okay? That is a given. But we have a conundrum that we have to deal with. And that conundrum has to do with the marriage of the trade union movement to a political party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You cannot, if the trade union movement and at the leadership level is married to a political party, then the rank and file, at the rank and file level, you don't see what your options are. You don't have time to you can't get to the front to raise the issue. That was the that was one of the reasons back in when the Million Worker March was formed, was to try to break that cycle, is to say that we would not, when we'd held that thing in Washington D.C., we didn't have any politicians up on that platform. Not a politician. I don't care whether it was Barbara Lee or whoever it was. They had no position. They didn't have. They could not speak from that platform. It was a workers' platform. Now, when you start start to talk about the coalescing of workers, whether they be Hispanic or Black or whatever they are, you first have to reach out to them. One of the first ways that trade unions are falling short of the mark, while they say they're for immigration reform, I've not heard one of them say, we want those workers that come across that border to be able to join unions. If they're able to join unions, then there can be no exploitation of that of those workers if those unions mean what they say.
But I agree with that.
You don't hear that. Will not hear. And I've been waiting for it for over 20-some-odd years. Hear somebody say, give those workers the right to organize.
Well, Terrence O'Sullivan from the laborers did say that at the Change to Win convention. He said, if you're a worker here, whether you're Black, Brown, whatever, you have a right to have a union. But the problem is that the Democrats with the Republicans are for more troops on the borders and for supporting more money to ICE to have these raids to terrorize workers, so they're afraid to organize unions. So when you're being terrorized, a community is being terrorized, you're fearful of joining a union, and that's what the employers want. But I did want to say, two things. One is the ILWU has a different tradition than most unions, because it was a left union that had a democratic structure. And that's one of the things that allowed May Day to take place and the Million Worker March, that the union itself, the membership, were able to discuss, debate, and take action that wasn't subverted by a top-down centralized leadership, which is important for workers to understand. The second thing is Labor Fest, which is happening this month, is going to have a forum on Black workers hanging nooses in the state of the labor movement on July the 19th, Saturday, July the 19th. The Modern Times bookstore and Leo is going to be part of that, and other trade unions, to talk about what is the state of the labor movement, Black workers and hanging nooses. And you can find out more about that by going to laborfest.net, because I think this debate, this discussion that we're having here, has to go on in a broader way among a large number
Absolutely.
Of workers.
You, as a young Black man in ILWU Local 10, the state of labor, what do you see?
I see it's the state of labor, being a young union man. It's once people get into a union, they become about themselves, and then they almost fall in and believe these stereotypes of everyone else. Like, I got mine, I worked hard, and that person can have theirs too if they work hard. So it's kind of this thing, once you get in the confine of the union, you got yours. People tend to want to make excuses for the other people who's still sitting in West Oakland in the areas that we pass up every day in Longshoremen. People who's out there dying, getting gunned down, selling drugs. There's no consciousness to even want to help those people. And I think a labor has to start from the bottom up. Instead of giving the money to the Democrats and sending millions, you know, have programs within the community that you work for and build up. Because if you don't do that, you say that these people don't matter. I want to start at the top to make sure I keep what I have and impress these rich capitalist people on top instead of starting at the bottom with programs.